Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Sorry, I'm a little bit late, but it wasn't my fault. It's these robes. You ever try to pee in a robe? All these layers you have to whip off as fast as you can, and then back on again in a certain ritualistic way. And as you get older, it gets worse. Anyway. So, wonderful to see you're all still here. We are right now in the heart of Zexin. And you may have assumed or hoped that you are leaving the world behind for a few days. But of course, the world is right here, with all of its attendant confusion and messiness. It hasn't gone anywhere. There is no escape. But in Zexin, we have the opportunity to see, feel, and hear, and yet not get entangled, or at least not entangle ourselves with our habitual reactions. And those reactions may arise. Frustration when the food is not there quite when you want it to be, for example. And when they do, though, we can let them go. We don't get dragged along by past conditioning. We don't get dragged along by our longing for comfort and ease, an internal whining that things are not as they should be. The difference between our everyday life and the time we are here in Zexin is that we face the wall of our experience. Remember, I talked about Luzu turning to the wall in my first talk. This is what we're doing. We look, sitting upright and silent. We witness what arises. And just witnessing opens the possibility of clarity and freedom. A clarity and freedom away or from the push and pull of our conditioning, of our karma. There's a definition of bodhisattvas that I really, really love. In Japanese, it's Gosho no Bonpu, Gansho no Bosatsu. Translated something like this: ordinary people are pulled by their karma. Bodhisattvas are those who live led by their vows. So maybe we can ask ourselves, will I be dragged by my conditioning and reactions, or led by my intention to live with clarity and freedom? We might all choose, of course, clarity and freedom. And to do so requires we also choose courage, patience, compassion. For to witness the walls of our life is not easy at times. To witness means we choose not to escape. And yet, there is the gift of our practice in how we don't escape. We simply return to the body and breath of this moment, and we rest in an awareness that's larger than the chattering mind. Please, brothers and sisters in the Dharma, Please continue to hold the silence and stillness in the face of the difficulties that arise, both inside you and outside, as we live together here. Let's continue to support each other with the knowledge that this practice, and indeed this life, is not easy for anyone. So I'd like to continue now with another koan. You know, there's 100 of them in this one book alone. We could be here for all months. So the case I'd like to bring forward is case 48, of Vimalakirti's non-duality. So let me read the case, and then we'll see what it may have to tell us. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, "What is a bodhisattva's method of entering non-duality?" Manjushri said, "According to my mind, in all things, no speech, no explanation, no direction, no representation, leaving behind all questions and answers. This is the method of entering non-duality." And then Manjushri turned and asked Vimalakirti, "We have spoken. Now you should say, good men, what is a bodhisattva's method of entry into non-duality?" Vimalakirti was silent. Last year, during our practice period, we studied and discussed the Vimalakirti Sutra. And those of you who are there remember it, perhaps. The Vimalakirti Sutra is considered one of the great jewels of the Mahayana canon, very influential in all forms of East Asian Buddhism. And it's quite interesting, in relatively just 14 pretty short chapters, all the main teachings of the Mahayana tradition are presented, and they're presented by a layperson named Vimalakirti, who in the sutra is supposedly ill. Now, I could go on and on about the sutra. It's pretty cool. This sutra is really spiritually imaginative. It uses poetry, humor, satire, short dramas, lavish descriptions, and wonderfully kind of cinematic situations to convey all the teachings. And I highly recommend reading it. And if you've already read it, read it again. The main character is Vimalakirti, and he is, I guess, what we may call a businessman today. But he was famed for his wisdom, compassion, and skillful means. He was honored by the Buddha, by all the Buddha's disciples, and the bodhisattvas. And all the town folk where he lived, Vaisali, this small town where he lived. So in the sutra, Vimalakirti is held up as a model for active and engaged lay Buddhist life. In this koan, that little bit that I just read, it repeats, almost word for word, one of the kind of dramatic teaching moments that are found in the sutra. Manjushri, who is the bodhisattva of wisdom itself. In fact, Manjushri is on the little altar there in the entranceway, carrying a sword to cut through delusions. So the very bodhisattva, the very essence of wisdom, is asked by the Buddha to pay a sick visit to Vimalakirti. Remember I said he's supposedly ill? So Manjushri goes with a great throng of monks and nuns and other bodhisattvas to go visit Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti, through psychic powers, knows that this great throng is coming. And so he somehow magically expands his humble 10x10 sick room, 10x10 foot sick room, to accommodate Manjushri and this great assembly that comes to visit him. As well as, get this, 3,200,000 visitors, and their great thrones, no less, from a distant Buddha land, all without crowding. So the discussion that happens after everyone has arrived and settled and various other little smaller events happen, the discussion between them turns to the best way to entering the Dharma gate of non-duality. And after a number of bodhisattvas have spoken, given their method of entering this Dharma gate of non-duality, giving their best advice, Manjushri speaks. And Manjushri, remember, as I said, is the bodhisattva of wisdom, the very archetype of wisdom, and greatly respected for his eloquence. And yet, when Manjushri asks Vimalakirti, Vimalakirti is silent. And then in the sutra, this silence is highly praised by Manjushri as the most eloquent presentation of entry into non-duality. Okay, that's the background. Now, what really struck me about this koan when I first read it was how it kind of holds up non-duality, but as soon as it holds up non-duality, what appears in my mind is its partner, duality. You know, it comes forward almost unbidden. We are, after all, creatures of duality, often thinking in terms of dualistic concepts like good and bad, compassion and meanness, large and small. As so much of our life, at least our thinking life, seems to be based on pairs of opposites. I like it, I hate it. Tasty, it's bland. They're a great prof, they're a crap prof. In our daily life, we often oscillate, right, between what the Buddhist tradition calls the eight worldly winds. I think Kate mentioned them in an earlier Dharma talk, of gain and loss, praise and blame, success and failure, fame and disrepute. And much of our discomfort and suffering arises from we swinging between these dualities, hoping for one and sadly finding ourselves in another. So Sesshin, this time here, gives us the opportunity to open to awareness how often we seesaw, right? How often we seesaw between, I don't want that. Give me some praise, please. You can just notice, as I've noticed in myself, the unbidden responses to the various dishes that appear at each meal. Like and dislike, grasping and aversion, pleasing and disappointing. Gruel again. Delicious. Gruel again. These are mild, right? These kind of things we experience. And yet we all know the vicious and contentious displays of duality are present in the world today. The media paints a bleak picture of extreme polarization in both the political and social realms. Scant middle ground to be found anywhere. So dealing with dualities is really a great part of our struggle. The struggle of our practice, both on and off the cushion. If you notice, before coming to Sichuan, oh, I can't wait to get there. So happy to get there. And then maybe day three, get me out of here. Get me out of here. Just oscillate back and forth. And have you noticed yourself proclaiming, even if it's just to yourself, that that last period of Zazen was really good? Or it was really scattered. The meal was good, the meal was not. The service was very moving, or it was kind of tiresome. Or maybe that last Dokzen, wow. Or what a waste of time. We're caught by a reflex to compare. And in the Buddhist tradition, this is called or known as conceits, as to be conceited. They're called conceits, or in Pali, mana. And I'd like to read you just a short passage from the Pali text, kind of talking about this, because it's quite apropos to our practice right now. So here's the passage, defining what mana or conceit is. And this is the Buddha speaking. Being inferior to somebody and considering that one is inferior, being inferior and considering that one is equal, being inferior and considering that one is superior, being equal and considering that one is inferior, being equal and considering that one is equal, being equal and considering that one is superior, being superior and considering that one is inferior, being superior and considering that one is equal, being superior and considering that one is superior. I think it's covered all the bases there. So this conceit refers to our constant comparison of ourselves to others. And interestingly, in the Buddhist understanding of conceit, it's divided into those three categories. Considering yourself inferior, just as good as, or superior. These are all forms of conceit. These are all forms of stories, narratives that get in the way of expressing who you truly are. And I think we can also apply this understanding or this practice of not comparing oneself to others to also comparing yourself or to an earlier or imagined self. I should be better than this after all my study and work. I should be kinder, more open, more generous, more forgiving, more enlightened after all this Zazen I've been doing, all this Dharma study I've undertaken. This is just another aspect of conceit and also another aspect of duality. The imagined self, how I should be, and the self that is present right now. Really, this dealing with dualities is a great part of the struggle of practice. What are all these dualities that just keep flowing up out of us? Where do they come from? I don't know. But let's move on a little bit. In my last talk, I commented on the rich vocabulary that developed in the Buddhist tradition to indicate and point at the ineffable. Right? Essential nature, true nature, Buddha nature, treasury of the true Dharma, I, nirvana, mind, original face. Non-duality is just one more of those words. The term indicates that two things we have understood as separate from one another are in fact not separate at all. They are so dependent, so intimate with each other, that they are in effect not two. Maybe to use the expression, simply two sides of the same coin. It's interesting when you think about it. Health and sickness, rich and poor, those kind of things seem to be two different concepts, but really they're not separate, because you cannot have one without the other. You can't have left without the right. If there was no left, how could you even think about a right? So I think we all have a good grasp of what duality is, two things. But what is the non-dual? What is this non-duality? Well, I don't think there's a satisfying definition. There is only the experience of it. And our Zazen practice brings us close to experiencing non-duality. Kate, in an earlier talk, has already mentioned the Genjo Koan, an essay written by Dogen. And here's the quote, same quote that Kate talked about. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized. Or we could say to realize our intimacy with the myriad things. Our hardened sense of self hinders our seeing, our experiencing of this intimacy that we have with all things. And the practice we do softens and maybe even sheds this strong sense of self. This is Dogen's teaching of Shinjin Datsuraku, kind of dropping off body and mind. And Dogen also emphasized the non-duality of practice and awakening. Over and over in his writing, he says, Zazen is not a means to the goal of awakening. The duality that we tend to fall into is assuming there's the practice and the goal. One's the means, and the other is the end. And Dogen knew that this was a trap. Keeps us caught in this view of duality. And so he talked about and practiced what's called shikantaza, just sitting. The practice of entering ever deeper into simple presence of this moment. Some teachers talk about this as boundless awareness, where even that sense of who is aware is woven into the awareness itself. I was thinking about this, and my thinking this was that all of us, I think, naturally want a spiritual practice we can understand. Don't we? You know, most conventional religious practices are really like that. We can kind of understand them. Well, there's prayer, okay, got a handle on that. Ritual, yeah. We do this and that. Chanting, yeah. Sounds pretty cool. Visualization, maybe. And so on. So these are practices we can kind of think of, we can conceive of and understand, and I do them, right? I do them. I'm going to chant, I'm going to do this ritual, I'm going to visualize bodhisattvas. But the Zazen, this practice that Dogen taught, is a different sort of practice. It is, I think, mysterious, and yet it is really a simple awareness that we drop into by dropping everything. An awareness that is deep enough and broad enough to encompass all things. Shinjin Datsuraku. And you may think, oh, okay, cool, got it. And just when we think that, when we understand it a little bit about non-duality, the Zen tradition immediately pulls the rug out from underneath us. Because there is a Zen expression that tells us, go beyond. Go beyond your sense of duality and non-duality, beyond the relative and the absolute, being and non-being, and all those other binary positions that we come up with. Because there is the mysterious dynamic of it all, which the Zen phrase is, not one, not two. Not one, not two. I don't really understand that. But here's my best guess, what the phrase is getting at. Because if we think, okay, oneness, then immediately there's two, right? And if you want to avoid two, you also then have to avoid the one. So Dogen calls this experience, or this dynamic of not one, not two, actualizing the fundamental point. Now, just another phrase, right? What the heck does that mean? Well, again, I don't think we can describe it. It's clear from Dogen's writing that the gateway to actualizing the fundamental point to this not one, not two, comes back to Zazen. We must experience. Because this not one, not two is a groundless, positionless position of nimbleness, radical openness. I'm going to stop here because I'm going to get lost. Not knowing. All those words, I'm sure, are not going to be much help. But the whole intent of that is just there is no end to this practice. And even when we feel, oh, the non-dual got pretty cool, go further. Go deeper. So in the koan, Manjushri describes his understanding of approaching the non-dual. According to my mind, all things, no speech, no explanation, no direction, no representation, leaving behind all questions and answers. This is the method of entering non-duality. Well, pretty good. And I thought pretty wordy. And this is typical of us humans, right? We want to know, we want to acquire the information, preferably in writing, please. I mean, just go to Banyan Books. And count the shelves stuffed with Dharma books and books on self-help. Does everyone know Banyan Books? Right. Well, you can probably imagine what kind of bookstore it is. We want to acquire information with the faith that it will save us from our turmoil. But the information, no matter how much we acquire, will not. Words only point the way, like the famous metaphor, the famous Zen metaphor, the finger pointing at the moon. So then in the koan, Manjushri then asked Vimalakirti, we have spoken, like all these bodhisattvas have given their opinion. Now you should say, good man, what is a bodhisattva's method of entering into non-duality? Well, Vimalakirti, as I said, was silent. And in the sutra, this is called a thunderous silence. The heart of the koan is Vimalakirti's response of silence. I was thinking, silence is such an interesting word. Because it's like the word space. It describes the presence of absence. And there are so many kinds of silence. There's the silence of surprise, shocked silence, angry silence, amused silence, hurt silence. Silence can be a door slammed shut in our face. And many have been silenced. Women, indigenous populations, the underclasses, minorities, racialized groups, those who protest against authoritarian leaders, powers. And I'm sure you can add to the list, for it is sadly a long one, and the ways of being silenced are many. I think in our practice in life, we must be aware of when we inappropriately silence ourselves or inadvertently silence others. But Vimalakirti's silence is not a cold or a frightening silence. It's not like those silences I just talked about. Vimalakirti's silence is the silence beyond words, a silence, the commentaries say, of awakening. It is the silence of the absence of silence itself. As I talked about just a few minutes ago, over these past few days, we've heard a host of words pointing towards the ineffable. Well, now here's one more, a silence. But this too is just a pointer. Katagiri Daiin Roshi, one of the first Japanese Soto Zen teachers in North America. He ended up teaching and had a number of Dharma heirs in Minnesota, and still active community there. Anyway, this is what Katagiri Roshi wrote. He says, Zazen is to come back to no sound. Come back to the sound of no sound and see it. It's not just your limited territory. It is a vastness from which your capacity, your knowledge, your nature comes, just like spring water coming up from the earth. This is Zazen, exactly. This is you. So he uses the word no sound instead of silence. It's not your limited territory. This silence, this no sound. It is a vastness from which your capacity, your knowledge, your nature comes, just like spring water coming up from the earth. How do we practice this? Every situation we encounter, I think, is an opportunity to practice this Dharma gate of non-duality. In each encounter, do not separate yourself. Do not isolate yourself. In part, this means to function for the benefit of more than just yourself. For the benefit of a sibling, a friend, a stranger, even an adversary. Our bodhisattva vows are a way that we practice the Dharma gate of non-duality. And in Zazen, each time you acknowledge a thought, something imagined, you know, we let it go. And we come back to our body, our breath, entering fully into the present moment. In doing that, we make a step towards non-duality. Our practices are not a matter of achieving, but a matter of letting go, a matter of dropping. Silence. we may think, okay, finally I get it. Silence is the answer. But silence is not always a good response. I don't want to leave us thinking that we finally have reached rock bottom here. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, there's a very beautiful scene where a goddess who is present at the gathering in Vimalakirti's sick room challenges Shariputra, one of the Buddha's foremost disciples, to speak, say something, and then calling his silence an evasion. So here's the scene. Shariputra turns to the goddess, he notices she's beside him, and says, "Oh, so have you been here a long time?" It sounds like a line you use at a party or something, at a bar. But the goddess immediately cuts to the quick. She says, "Venerable sir," said the goddess, "how long has your attainment of awakening been?" That'd be quite a comeback. And Shariputra was silent and did not answer. Guess who he's copying here? The goddess said, "With your great wisdom, venerable sir, why do you remain silent?" And Shariputra replied, "Awakening cannot be spoken of in words. Therefore, I do not know what I can say to you." And the goddess said, "Words, writing, are all marks of awakening. Why? Because awakening is not internal or external, not in between. Words likewise are not internal, not external, and not in between. Therefore, Shariputra, you can speak of awakening without putting words aside. Why? Because all things that exist are marks of awakening." Get the point? She's saying, "Look, stupid. Everything is intimate. Everything is woven together. Don't think words are separate from your silence." So Shariputra assumed that silence is the opposite of language. But the goddess put him straight. Language can be a prison. And silence can be a prison. And language can awaken, and silence can awaken. Much depends on how we use them, what we make of them. Our experience of silence is manifold, inclusive, excluded, excluding, a gate to non-duality, something that's isolating. Reflecting on this koan, let's go deeper into silence throughout the day. Listening to the inner sounds, sounds of our body, sounds of our chattering mind, and listening to the outer sounds, rain, wind, clattering of dashes on ceramic plates, receiving the silence that is the foundation of all sounds, aware in those moments, just rest in the brilliance of the here and now, entering the gate of non-duality. Thank you for listening.